content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading from the January and February 2023 issue of Smithsonian. We'll begin with an article titled Sheer Willpower by Tony Perrottet, The Life of the Last Empress. A fresh view of Galla Placidia, who married a barbarian and ruled during the Roman Empire's decline. On the night of August 24th, 410, the Roman princess Galla Placidia was waiting for the end of the world. Although she left no record of her feelings on that fateful evening, we can recreate the scene as the 20-year-old noblewoman wandered the imperial palace complex on the Palatine Hill in the heart of the ancient city. Her surroundings exuded all the ancient splendor and confidence of the Roman Empire, the greatest the Western world had ever seen. The floors and walls of the palace were a kaleidoscope of colored marble embedded with gold and precious gems. Silver fountains burbled in the courtyards. Antique statues of military heroes and illustrious Caesars jostled with artwork and trophies brought back by the conquering legions from far-flung corners of the Mediterranean. This was Rome, a megalopolis, where glittering avenues, monuments, and arches littered the landscape. A census listed 46,602 multi-story tenement buildings, 1,790 palatial villas, 856 bathhouses, 28 libraries, and 1,352 fountains, not to mention 10 aqueducts and a sewage system. However, the city had fallen on hard times since the golden age of great emperors like Trajan, Hadrian, and Marcus Aurelius, more than two centuries earlier. Its cosmopolitan population had shrunk from 1 million to 600,000, and lawlessness reigned in many streets. The gladiatorial spectacles and the Colosseum were shut down in 404, leaving the chariot races as the main public entertainment. But even in decay, there was no rival to Roma Aeterna, the eternal city, Caput Mundi, the head of the world, invincible and invulnerable, or so its citizens had believed for some 800 years. In 410, Rome's situation was teetering toward the unimaginable. Camped in the countryside around its titanic marble-sheathed defensive walls was a vast army of some 100,000 warriors led by the king of the Visigoths, Western Goths, named Alaric, who marched from the Balkans under the banner of a black crow. The enemy army besieged Rome for 3 months, blocking its 12 gates and all transport on the Tiber River. With her classical education, Placidia would have recalled Homer's haunting description of the Trojan army in the Iliad. The enemy campfires were so numerous, he wrote, they blazed like stars in the night sky. The emperor Honorius, Placidia's half-brother, had long since abandoned Rome to its fate. Of the imperial family, only the princess had remained, offering her regal support to the Senate as it worked to stave off disaster. Now the city was on its knees. The population was starving. Bodies piled up in the streets. Rumors of cannibalism spread. Disease ran rampant. Many pagans blamed the Christians. Placidia's own father, Theodosius the Great, had ordered dozens of pagan temples in the city closed, snuffed out the sacred flames of the Vestal Virgins, and banned the sacrifices to the ancient gods who had protected Rome from enemy incursion for 8 centuries. It was around midnight that the cataclysm began. Placidia would have heard distant sounds of Gothic horns and growing pandemonium around the Salarian Gate in the city's northwest. Not long afterward, flames could be seen rising from the nearby gardens of Sallust. The Goths had breached the walls. The British-born monk, Pelagius, who was also trapped in Rome that same night, used language that echoed the biblical vision of Judgment Day to convey the horror of the moment. Rome, the mistress of the world, shivered, crushed with fear, at the sound of the blaring trumpets and the howling of the Goths. Saint Jerome, who had heard the dreadful news from Roman refugees, captured the sense of shock. "It is the end of the world," he wrote. "Words fail me. Sobs prevent me from speaking. The city that once subjected the world has been subjected in its turn." For Romans, it was the beginning of the end. But for Placidia, it was just one more twist in an astonishing life saga that could have inspired a subplot of Game of Thrones. After the sack, the pampered and beautiful princess would be taken from her gilded palace as a prisoner of the Visigoths. 4 years later, Placidia shocked Romans by marrying one of her captors. Then, by age 26, she was back in Italy, reinventing herself to rule as the last empress of the Western Roman Empire. And yet, she had been treated mercilessly by historians, who have either vilified or ignored her for most of the last 1,500 years. This has left her today all but forgotten, even though the final decades of the Western world's most enduring empire cannot be understood without her. Cleopatra, Joan of Arc, Catherine the Great. To the roster of history's unfairly maligned women leaders must be added the name of Galla Placidia Augusta. Although her name in Latin means placidity or peace, Placidia's life was anything but. She experienced more adventures than Marie Antoinette and Amelia Earhart combined. Perhaps no other figure, male or female, enjoyed such an intimate view of the Western Roman Empire's operatic death throes, or influenced events for such a long, prolonged period. But the attacks on her reputation began not long after her death, with authors like Cassiodorus denouncing her rule as the nadir of Rome's fortunes. Only in recent years have scholars gone back to read the contemporary sources with more objectivity, revealing Placidia as a far more sympathetic figure, a strong-willed leader with radical ideas on how to save the crumbling empire. It's part of a general reassessment of her era, known as Late Antiquity, once dismissed as a gloomy saga of decline and fall to the Middle Ages, including a fresh look at so-called barbarians, who were far more sophisticated than Romans alleged. Placidia had an amazingly adventurous life, explained Paola Novara, a scholar at the National Museum of Ravenna, who has written about Placidia's legacy, including her influence on art and architecture throughout Europe. She was a hostage for years. She was married twice, to a Gothic king, then to Rome's most powerful general. She had one child who died, another who became emperor. She must have been a very strong and powerful character, but there has long been a negative image of Placidia, she continued. She was not a bad sovereign. She was brave and capable. In fact, Placidia was the last significant ruler of the Western Roman Empire. She managed it for 25 years. The violation of Rome in 410 would have seemed a fantastical idea to Placidia or any Roman citizen only 6 years earlier. On January 1st, 404, the teenage princess, wearing flowing golden robes with a ceremonial headdress, has watched as Honorius stage a triumphal procession through the city's grand avenues with his general Stilicho to celebrate their victory over the Visigoth hordes. The omens were excellent. Torrential rain the night before gave way to glorious winter sunshine, making Rome's marble monuments sparkle as if they had been polished by a divine hand. Honorius in Stilicho rode in a chariot ahead of marching legions while throngs of citizens cheered deliriously and showered them with petals as they wound from the Forum, the city's most ancient and revered piazza, crowded with imposing temples and marble-sheathed monuments up the steep Capitoline Hill. The future of the empire seemed assured. Even at this young age, Placidia had already seen more than her fair share of peril and violence. Born around 390, the daughter of a patrician named Galla and Emperor Theodosius the Great, she had spent her infancy as Nobilissima Puella, most noble girl, in the great palace of Constantinople in modern Istanbul, where the royal family could watch dolphins at play while being fanned with peacock feathers by eunuchs. Her father was a brilliant general, but a man of extreme religious beliefs. He had changed the course of history in 380 by making Christianity the official state religion of the empire. And then, in 392, he banned all other faiths entirely. The subsequent culture war was conducted with zeal. Fanatical Christian mobs leveled the most hallowed shrines of antiquity, including the sanctuary of Olympia in Greece, site of the Olympic Games for nearly 1,200 years, and possibly destroying the statue of Zeus, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Egged on by radical bishops, monastic vigilantes, armed with cudgels, roamed the eastern provinces, burning temples and synagogues. Around the age of five, Placidia became an orphan, which likely honed her independence within the venomous imperial court. By age six, she had traveled with the legions overland to Milan. She eventually moved to Rome, while her teenage half-brother, Honorius, was elevated as emperor and moved the western capital in 401 to Ravenna, an Adriatic port that could be more easily defended from assaults by hostile armies and usurpers. Honorius proved to be an extravagantly incompetent ruler. He was as dim-witted as his older brother Arcadius, who was derided by critics for his halting speech and drooping eyes, and who allowed his courtiers to lead him like an ox. Another scathing description of Arcadius as a spineless sensualist, living the life of a jellyfish, could equally have applied to Honorius, whose indifference to matters of state would prove disastrous. The daily business of running the empire often fell to the many capable women in court, such as Placidia's cousin Serena, who married the general Stilicho and managed affairs from Rome while he went on campaign after the first eruption of Alaric and his Visigoths into Italy in 401. Stilicho's resounding victories in the next 2 years restored Romans' confidence. The barbarian threat had been diffused, just as it had been many times over centuries past. The callow Honorius had never set foot on the battlefield, but he claimed the honor of a military triumph in 404 as Stilicho's superior. The victory parade ended on the Capitoline Hill, the city's most sacred point, presided over by the temple of Jupiter Optimus Maximus. But in a break with tradition, the Christian Honorius declined to offer sacrifice to the king of the gods. Although Rome's sacred sites had been shuttered and their rites banned, many citizens remained staunchly pagan in their hearts, and their city as an island of heathenism. Now, some pagans muttered in private that the offended Jupiter would withdraw his protection. Little that happened during the next 6 years offered proof to dissuade them. The triumph of 404 proved to be a false dawn. From his refuge in Ravenna, Honorius hopelessly mismanaged the defense of the Western Empire. In 408, he became suspicious of Stilicho and had his most talented general arrested and beheaded. He then bungled relations with the Goths, refusing to negotiate with Alaric over his demand to help his people find food, yet failing to prepare an army to confront him. While Honorius ignored his overtures, Roman troops massacred the families of Gothic soldiers who were serving as mercenaries in the legions. In 408, the exasperated Alaric marched across the Alps with an estimated 30,000 soldiers and 150,000 camp followers, a roving refugee nation. When Alaric blockaded Rome for the first time, the previously little-noticed Placidia revealed that she inherited her father's strong-willed and ruthless character. A rumor spread that her cousin Serena was plotting with the Goths. For Placidia, it was an opportunity to seize influence. She conspired with the Senate to have Serena condemned and publicly strangled, making the princess the highest-ranking imperial family member in Rome. As Romans were pushed to near starvation, the Senate paid Alaric a ransom of 42 wagons full of treasure, although the Visigoths remained in Italy. In the spring of 410, Honorius agreed to meet Alaric, but even though the Visigoth army was constantly being reinforced, soon numbering 100,000 men at arms, the Roman treated the Goths' demands with disdain, and negotiations came to nothing. Until now, Alaric had hesitated to carry his attack on Rome to its bloody conclusion, hoping to come to a compromise. Though a Christian, he apparently also feared the wrath of Roma, the pagan goddess who personified Rome, if he were to violate her sacred city. Superstitious or not, by the summer of 410, he felt he had no choice but to attack in order to feed his horde of followers. Nobody knows how the Visigoths managed to enter the Salarian Gate on the night of August 24th. Some said it was opened from within by servants of a pious Christian noblewoman, Faltonia Proba, who wanted to end the Romans' misery. Another possibility suggested by historians is that it was opened by rebellious slaves who had no love for the old Roman order and preferred to take their chances with the enemy so reviled by their masters. The next 3 days shook the world. The pillaging began in surprisingly orderly fashion. The Goths were Christians of a sect known as Arianism versus the Catholics of the official church. And Alaric had given strict orders that his men should respect Rome's holy churches and monasteries, where many terrified citizens found safety. Stories were later told of devout Christian women who were able to carry religious treasures to safety, but other Romans were tortured to reveal their hidden wealth. The Goths stripped statues and palaces of their precious metals and gems, including a 4-foot-tall golden menorah once looted from the Temple of Herod in Jerusalem. Fighting erupted in many parts of the city, and it descended into savagery when Hun mercenaries ran riot. Fires spread, corpses carpeted the splendid avenues. To the horror of Roman aristocrats, all distinctions of birth were forgotten in the chaos. The monk Pelagius wrote, "Everyone was thrown together and shaken with fear. Every household had its grief, and an all-pervading terror gripped us. Slave and noble were one. The same specter of death stalked us all." After 3 days, the Goths abandoned Rome, where there was no food for the vast army. But refugees from the disaster would spread across the Mediterranean, telling tales of horror, traumatizing, for example, the devout bishop St. Augustine in Roman North Africa. Nearly shattered by the news, he began writing his masterwork, City of God, to explain why such a tragedy could be part of a divine plan. In Ravenna, meanwhile, the emperor was unfazed. When a courtier rushed in with news that Rome had perished, writes ancient chronicler Procopius, Honorius thought that one of his beloved pet roosters named Rome had died, wailing, "And yet it has just eaten from my hands." The emperor was indifferent to the city's dire fate, but he was relieved his chicken had survived. Along a road lined with thousands of pagan graves and the multi-layered catacombs of the Christians, the Gothic army traveled after the 3-day sack, leading wagons bulging with loot and a contingent of high-born Roman hostages, of whom by far the most valuable was the 20-year-old Placidia. Alaric assigned his captive to his brother-in-law, a cavalry leader named Altulf, who was the later Roman historian Jordanus, writes, "A man of imposing beauty and great spirit. Otulf ensured that Placidia enjoyed all the honor and ceremony due to her imperial rank. Traveling in a padded carriage with at least one slave, and perhaps a small collection of silks and jewels, Placidia would turn the disgrace into an extraordinary advantage. For the next 4 years, she accompanied the marauding Visigoths around the Mediterranean in what turned into an endless search for grain. As her wagon creaked along the superbly engineered highways, Placidia may at first have tried to maintain her own world of Roman comforts. And yet, historians surmise Placidia would also have been exposed to, and perhaps adapted to, her captor's way of life. She would have eaten strange Germanic stews around evening fires. To endure the winters outdoors, she probably wore exotic furs and leathers. She may have even tried using soap instead of olive oil while bathing. She evidently discovered that the barbarians were far more urbane than the dismissive Romans realized, or the common image passed down to us today. Their warrior nobles wore trousers rather than togas, but many leaders had been educated in Rome, spoke Latin and Greek fluently, and deeply admired classical art and letters. Alaric himself had trained in Italy to become a mercenary general and had fought alongside Placidia's father, Theodosius, at the Battle of Frigidus in 394. The xenophobic Romans refused to accept the Goths as equals or deal with them honestly. But during her captivity, Placidia developed a more sympathetic view, and she decided that an alliance between Roman and barbarian was the best hope to keep the empire intact. Alaric's superstitious dread must have seemed justified when he became sick and died, probably from malaria, only months after ravaging Rome. The Visigoths were then campaigning in the far south of Italy, and they buried their beloved king at the peninsula's toe, hiding his tomb so well that its lavish treasures still have not been found today. Chosen as his successor was Placidia's guardian, Altulf. In January of 414, the captive princess astonished Romans by agreeing to marry this handsome new Visigoth king, apparently quite willingly. Though not tall of stature, Jordanus writes, Altulf was distinguished for beauty of face and form. For his part, Altulf was attracted to Placidia's nobility, beauty, and chaste purity. The army was by then crossing southern Gaul, modern France, and a lavish wedding ceremony was held in a villa in Narbonne, a lovely coastal city in today's south of France. A mixed marriage, if ever there was one. The rite was Roman in style, but attended by local Roman nobles and Goths alike. Sending a clear message through fashion, Placidia wore imperial silks and Altulf the armor of a Roman general. Together, the cross-cultural pair advocated a radical dream. As Altulf explained in his wedding speech, his desire had once been to destroy the empire and turn it into Gothia, instead of Romania, with himself as a new Caesar. But now he longed for peace. He and his people were tired of their endless wanderings around southern Europe. Instead of fighting for their own kingdom, the Goths would now become Roman citizens, accept imperial laws, become integrated into Rome's society, and defend its borders. In short, Altulf and Placidia would renew his ailing empire. The royal house of Theodosius could now be backed by the manpower of the Goths. Altulf admitted that he had come to this conclusion aided by the persuasion and advice of his wife, a woman of surpassing intellect and a faith beyond reproach. It's very plausible. As the Roman historian Tacitus once noted in surprise, German men, unlike the deeply sexist Romans, valued women's opinions. They did not despise women's counsels or make light of their answers. According to Joyce E. Salisbury, author of the Placidia biography, Rome's Christian Empress, the princess may have privately calculated that this was the only way for her to secure independence. Even if she was ransomed and returned to her doltish brother Honorius, who had no heirs, she would be married off as a pawn in the court's power game. As a wedding gift, Hotolf gave his bride 50 young men dressed in silk as her personal guards, each carrying two plates, one piled with gold, the other with precious gems, all plundered from Rome. As marriage hymns were sung, the guests enjoyed a feast featuring Gaulish wines and desserts flavored with rosemary flower honey. It may have been Placidia's idea that the Visigoths locate their new base in the fertile provinces of Spain, her family's ancestral homeland. Arriving in Barcino, modern Barcelona, Placidia bore Autolf a son. Instead of a royal Gothic name, they christened the boy Theodosius after her Roman grandfather, the revered warrior emperor. The future looked bright. However, after only a few months, the infant Theodosius died. The morning Placidia and Autolf wrapped the body in gold cloth and laid it in a tiny silver coffin, which after a torchlit procession was buried in a chapel. Worse was to come. In 415, Autolf was attacked by a resentful servant and stabbed in the groin. The wound soon proved to be lethal. The new Gothic king, Sigeric, who seized the throne after Autolf's assassination, wanted to remove all threat to his rule and personally butchered Autolf's daughters from his first marriage, tearing them from the arms of a bishop who tried to protect them. Placidia was only saved by her royal Roman blood. Instead of being executed, she was forced to walk in front of Sigeric's horse with other Roman prisoners during Autolf's 12-mile funeral procession as an act of humiliation. She was then ransomed for a vast quantity of Roman grain, 600,000 measures, and bundled off to Honorius. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. We'll pick up and finish that article about Placidia next episode. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.